Hello, welcome to Mosaics, a podcast from the Idaho Office for Refugees. I'm your host, Holly Beach. Today I'm here with Lisa Morado. She is the program lead of Boise State's Global Studies Program, which she helped create. And along with teaching, Lisa also researches the intersections between global migration, human rights, and environmental justice. Lisa grew up here in Idaho for the first 18 years of your life, and she's lived in Ecuador, Cuba, and Costa Rica as part of her studies of global studies and anthropology. She also has a master's degree in international development and a PhD in cultural and environmental anthropology. And Lisa, I'm just so excited to chat with you today and learn from your insights, from your research and your experience. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I'd love to hear about what inspired you to get into global studies.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I grew up here in Boise, Idaho, and I graduated high school in 1993 at 18 years old, and I just said, I want out. And I think I said, I'm never coming back. I went to a small liberal arts college called Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma. And I was originally signed on to do nursing, so I was in the pre-nursing program. And found that I did not enjoy chemistry class, and actually kind of contemplated whether even college was the right move for me. But I was having a down day and I ran into a friend of mine from the dorms and she said, "Hey, Lisa, what are you doing next year?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "Well, you want to go to Ecuador with me?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah." And so I signed on for a one semester study abroad in Ecuador. And that was like such an amazing experience for me on so many levels. One, I grew up in Boise, which was a small town back then. And so Guayaquil is this huge city. And I lived with this amazing host family, big family, lots of big meals. And I had to learn to get around the city. I knew some Spanish from high school and also from my grandmother spoke Spanish, but I didn't know that much. And so, like, definitely that was like a chance to learn how to navigate while speaking Spanish. So it was a really incredible experience. And I went there and I was working as a nursing assistant in this hospital in Guayaquil with premature babies. And as I was there, I just started kind of asking questions like, why is there so much poverty here? Why don't these women have the resources that they need? And so I started kind of thinking about other kinds of studies that might kind of address like the problems that were leading to this, the state of the hospital and the poverty that these women were experiencing. And then I came back after that study abroad, and I had signed up for an anthropology 102 class, cultural anthropology. And by the end of that first class, I was like, that's it. That's what I want to be. I want to be an anthropologist. And I want to help study, what are these big global problems that that lots of communities are facing. So that was the beginning.
So you know firsthand what it's like to be a newcomer in a different culture, a different country. Do you have any memories that kind of share anything valuable that you learned, or maybe even like a difficult or a funny memory that for you was kind of gives you more empathy maybe now for someone who is a newcomer here?
Yeah, definitely. So I was 19 years old at the time, I had grown up here in Boise. My mom's half the family is Mexican-American. My dad's half the family mostly German American. But I kind of grew up not really having a sense of my own ethnic identity. And it was funny when I was in Ecuador, because we would sit around at night and do homework with my host sisters, who were also college students. And they would ask me like, what are you? And I was like, I don't know. And I just told them about my family history. And they said, you're Latina. That's it. Like, and they had, that was like such a cool moment for me because I was like, yeah, I am.
That resonated with you?
Yeah. No one had really ever said that to me before. And so it was really that like being in a different place and then having And I think this happens for a lot of people that travel and live abroad. Like, you gain insights about yourself through that process of living somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Can you share more about your family background and maybe how that, your childhood or just how you grew up or your family heritage has continued to influence the work that you do today?
Yeah. So I grew up in Boise, kind of over what I call mall land now. But when I was growing up, it was mostly just dirt lots around the subdivision.
Crazy how much Boise has changed in such a short time.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's a very different place. Personally, I think in a good way.
So, I think so, too.
Yeah. So, yeah, we grew up. My parents, we were very working class family. My dad, his family came from eastern Idaho where they were potato farmers. So my dad grew up on a potato farm and moved to Boise later for work. And then my mom's family, they came here from Texas and before that from Mexico. So a lot of Latinos in Idaho have come from Texas, actually. That's a pretty typical stopping point for a few years. So they were in San Antonio and then moved here to Idaho. And my parents met through through the Catholic Church, actually. So, yeah, that's I have a brother and a sister. And, yeah, we grew up just kind of I just feel like I'm a good Idaho representative.
You got the potatoes in there.
You got the potatoes. My dad worked for Boise Cascade, and he was a big advocate of making healthy forests through logging. And so kind of grew up with that perspective, which was really interesting too.
Yeah, that's very cool. You study and teach about global migration, which right now we have seen unprecedented numbers of people who have been displaced, whether that is someone who would qualify for refugee status, displaced because of persecution on just the core factors of who they are, or others are displaced by war and climate change and other things like that. So you you study this, you teach this. And I did want to kind of narrow in on one specific country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, just because that has been for many years the top nation of origin for people resettling in Idaho through refugee resettlement. So I wanted to better understand the circumstances or the situation maybe around that. I was hoping you could share some of your insights.
Yeah, I'd be happy to give a disclaimer that I'm not an expert on this region. So, and I know you've had folks on your podcast that live there and have that expertise. So, but I'm happy to talk about it from maybe like the way we would approach it in a global studies class. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, if the question is like, why are there so many refugees and displaced people coming out of the Congo, out of the DRC, It's a complicated story, and I feel like a lot of times in the media, it kind of gets represented as there's just this ethnic conflict, or like people just can't get along, or there's like tribal issues. And I think that really glosses over the complexity of it. I mean, you really have to go far back in time and understand like the history of colonialism and the carving up of Africa and how really, you know, in the 1800s, there was just this, like, some people call it the scramble for Africa. And European countries were coming in and claiming the land and putting down these arbitrary borders. And that has so many ramifications that still exist today. So while those countries eventually were able to achieve independence, some of those legacies of colonial rule were still in place. So, for example, the way the whole global system works is that the resources would be extracted from Africa, and the European colonial powers would benefit from that. So there was just a kind of an extraction and then wealth given to the colonial powers. And those sort of market forces still exist today. And so we can look at the example of cobalt, which is mined in the DRC. I believe they have like the largest reserves of cobalt of anywhere else on Earth. And so there are multinational corporations that are have mining operations, and the cobalt is extracted, but the wealth doesn't stay in the DRC. It leaves with the multinational corporation. And instead, what has happened is that the mines have become sites where there's human trafficking. And so people are being exploited. There's definitely child labor that's occurring in the mines. And so that sort of like practice that started all the way back with the beginning of colonialism of just taking but not sharing those benefits with the people is a huge part of the process. And so there is ethnic conflict. That is true. That is one of the drivers of the instability there. And most of the things that I have read lately, the predictions aren't looking great for the next few years. So the violence and conflict has been increasing, will probably continue to increase. And then you throw in climate change and how that might cause further instability. And then the other sort of piece of this, like, because we see here in Boise people who have made it through the refugee program and been granted a pathway to the United States, but there's a huge amount of internally displaced people. The majority of people who leave DRC go to other African countries first. And then there are other displaced people who come into the DRC. And so there's such a huge amount of displacement that it's going to be challenging for many years to come.
And when you talk about this with your global studies students, I know when we talked about this earlier, we're talking about even our phones. Isn't cobalt used in the production of a lot of the technology that we use? Like, we don't always realize the chain of events that it took for us to just, you know, buying a phone doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but those kind of things that you kind of talk through with your students.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually do a project in my Global Studies 101 class where we look at, we take like a phone and then we look at all the different parts of the world that contributed to the different resources that go into the phone. And so cobalt is one of those. And it's a really good way for us to like remember how we're all interconnected. So to think that like the phone that you're using has cobalt that very well could have come from the DRC and labor that might have happened in any part of the world. And try to use that as an example of like our interconnectedness. And I would like throw that into the, like, when people say like, what's the challenge for the DRC? What's the problem? And just say that it's collectively, it's all of our challenge because we're all connected.
And the history of things that happen continue to have ripple effects today that go on. What can we do from all the way over here? Or do you have any advice on that, or like how you can be part of the solution?
I mean, there's lots of ways that you can be a part. You can support organizations that are supporting people who come from refugee backgrounds. You can learn. You can just like keep an open mind and kind of have that learner's mindset as you go about. And I think like any time that you can just raise awareness of how interconnected we are globally, that can just be really powerful for changing how someone might feel. Like if someone's feeling apprehensive or wondering like, why are people being sent to Boise or Twin Falls or anywhere, and just to have that like mindset ahead of time that we were already connected. And this is just another layer of that connectivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for sharing about that and helping build that deeper level of understanding that goes back historically. I think that's really important. You also have focused your research on homeland security policies at the border with the lens of nature conservation and human rights protections. What are some of your main takeaways from that research?
Yeah, so I became fascinated with the border when I was in college. And my sister and I actually, we did a reverse migration path and we went from Boise and back down through San Antonio and then crossed the border all the way down to our grandmother's hometown, Monterrey and Saltillo. And in crossing the border that time, I was just fascinated by like, the just the difference. You cross this line and there's just like two completely different realities in terms of like wealth and pollution. And it was really striking. So I became interested in the border and actually did my PhD research on the U.S.-Mexico border. I was working at a wildlife refuge, and I went down with the question that I had at that time is there was a lot of media reporting on migrants crossing the border and sort of trashing the border and leaving clothes and water bottles and how this was bad for the environment. And so I went down with wanting to explore that. And I ended up working at this wildlife refuge. And over the course of about a year and a half, I collected data trying to understand like really what was the environmental impact. And what I found is that like, yes, there was trash left on these sort of migration routes that people were crossing through. But like the biggest environmental degradation was coming from Border Patrol and sort of the methods that they were using to chase people and to like they drag their tires across the soil so they can mark for footprints. And then like people don't often think about like the environmental impact of like building the walls and the fences. And people talk about maybe like wildlife being able to cross. But that actual construction of the walls and the fences has a huge environmental impact. And we have this kind of interesting set of regulation around this, which is that according to U.S. policy, Homeland Security policy, when you're securing the border, you don't have to follow all of the other traditional environmental protection regulations. So basically like security trumps environment in that situation. So like any sort of water protection, air protection, endangered species, none of that counts in the border region. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a lot of environmental degradation.
Did you have much opportunity there to interact with people who were there trying to seek a better life?
No. Just for ethical reasons, I didn't want to put anyone in danger by talking to me. So my research was really focused on the folks who were doing the conservation on the U.S. side and trying to understand how they were responding to this inflow of people coming through Arizona.
With your global studies research, are there any factors that might help people better understand the situation at the border or the trends? I know that can create a lot of concern, but we don't always have the complex understanding of what's happening. Do you have anything that you either share with your students or that you could share with us today that's kind of just a helpful grounding of knowledge in what's happening?
Yeah. So when we look at the U.S.-Mexico border and there's a lot of fear that is sort of thrown around when we talk about the border. And so, again, like I kind of go to the historical context. And during World War II, when we had a labor shortage, we started the Bracero program, which was bringing Mexican workers in to help us harvest our food. And so that was a program that was started by the United States government. And when the war ended, they decided to stop that program. But all of these workers had kind of established a cycle of coming here to work, work in agriculture, and then going home to Mexico in the winter to be with their families. And so when the Bracero program stopped, people were still working. It just wasn't sanctioned anymore. And so really understanding that, like, migration has been going on for hundreds of years, decades. Yeah. And it's not a new thing. I think that agriculture is a really good way to think about it. And the vast majority of our agricultural workforce comes from an immigrant background. And really, we truly would not have a functioning agricultural system without immigrant workers. And so just And it's kind of circling back, like what we were talking about at the beginning, like as you're eating dinner with your family, remember that like that someone had to plant that and harvest it and drive it and get it to the grocery store. And immigrants are just the heart and the soul of our agricultural system. And so that's related. I mean, that doesn't like take away the fact that we do have a challenge at our southern border. And, you know, that will always continue as long as there are like disparities between the global north and the global south. People will be trying to seek out economic opportunity. That's not going to go away. But I think just kind of maybe kind of shifting your mindset to recognition that the plate, the food in front of you is intricately tied to global migration.
And that gratitude.
Yeah.
I like that. That's great. Throughout your years in this field, and I'm really happy, by the way, that you found your way. I love to see when people switch, or, you know, they start out thinking one thing, because I think there's a lot of pressure on a freshman in college, which you probably know this from being the mom of someone who's just starting college. There's so much pressure to choose and to get it right the first time. And I love when people can evolve and have a new experience and then let that direct their path. Have there been other ways throughout your studies that your mindset or your thinking or your approach has evolved, maybe about a certain topic or about what interests you?
I mean, it's constantly evolving. I think that's just how I try to approach my life, like is always being open to new experiences. I think one of the joys that I've had teaching at Boise State is connecting with our international students. And so that's just, it's so amazing to have a diverse classroom and the conversations that we can have. So I learn a lot from my students, not both international and students from here. I'm grateful for that opportunity. Like we think about like the teacher, the professor teaching the students, but we also learn so much from our students.
And have you noticed over the years a shift in the ways students are thinking or the kind of questions they're asking or their awareness of global issues?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that like just to speak in like broad strokes, I think that there's a greater sense of global connections now. I think that there's broadened awareness of this awareness of like because of the sort of economic global dynamics that are out there, that we have this sort of great divide between wealthy countries and poor countries. And I think students are more attuned to that now, which is great because that can help us maybe, you know, get a new generation of people working on these problems and mm-hmm. trying to help make the world a little bit more equitable and just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the global awareness and connection. So when I was in college, oh gosh, I'm going to go back here. I think Twitter was founded like the year I started college. But now we have like Instagram, TikTok, and even recently there are these young Palestinian men in Gaza that would share on TikTok a day in the life of, and they would do this every day. And that human connection, it wasn't like years later, this was in a textbook that you get to read, like you're in real time hearing straight from them. And I think more students probably have that now and come into it with more global connectedness that just did not exist before.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the flip side of that is also a challenge because there's a lot of misinformation out there too. And so mm-hmm. That's one of the really important things that we do at the college level is like making sure that people can ascertain like is this a good source or is this not a good source, and kind of having trusted ways that you get your information. But yeah, I mean overall I think that those sorts of podcasts and A Day in the Life really does help to connect us on a human level, mm-hmm. a face-to-face level. So yeah, and I think, you know, for the global studies program, like we really encourage our students to study abroad. Mm-hmm. And that's one of like the core pillars, and lots of students study abroad at Boise State. of all majors. And I just think that's like, if you can, that is absolutely the most amazing experience. One kind of cool thing about the Global Studies program as we were creating it is that we recognize that not everyone can study abroad. And so we were thinking about like our non-traditional students, our students who are parents, students who are taking care of their parents, that really want to like understand these global issues. It's amazing that Boise has become such a diverse place. And there are so many organizations like yours that are working with people from refugee backgrounds. And there's lots of farm worker support, farm worker advocacy organizations, that sort of thing. And so students can actually have a global experience just right here. And so that's like, kudos to Boise for being the kind of city that, that we can have those experiences. And another just sort of recognition that like, yeah, if you can study abroad, that's great. But if you can't, there are things that you can do right here in town.
I love that. And that makes me so proud to live in Boise, the fact that we have all these different cultures represented, different countries represented. And I think that just makes it such a special place to live. So I'm really grateful for that aspect of it, even though it stems from, you know, it's sad. It stems from tragedy. But then what people have created out of that is really beautiful. So that's cool. And if your students ever are looking for help getting connected, you can send them my way. I've chatted with other people before that are like, how can I get a cultural experience here in Boise? And there's so many opportunities. So I'm happy to share those with any of your students that might be looking.
Awesome. Thank you.
You also study, you're just studying so much. I'm like just fascinated by your life. You also study farm workers and in a way that you learn from them as well, their ecological knowledge, maybe tactics they brought from their home country. And one of the projects you're doing now with students involves Global Gardens, which is a program of the Idaho Office for Refugees to equip and empower farmers largely from refugee backgrounds. So we're going to talk more about that in a different episode that will involve your students, which I'm really excited. But can you just give us a teaser of what that might look like?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So when I moved back to Idaho, 18 years after I left, and I swore I would never come back, and I
here
came
you are.
Back, and here I am, and I love being at Boise State. I started doing research here with farm workers, and mostly with women farm workers, but over the past 7 or 8 years, done just a lot of research with my colleague, Rebecca Som Castellano. She's in sociology. And part of what I learned from doing these years of research is that like we have this term farm worker, and it's used to like signify that it's unskilled labor. Mm. And I really push back against that idea. And I think that we should see farm work as farming. And so I'm really trying to like just eliminate that word and have farmers just be farmers. And if you're growing food and harvesting food, you are a farmer. And so to try to like understand the skills that are involved, one of the things that I learned about in my PhD program is traditional ecological knowledge. Took that concept and said like, what are farmers in Idaho? What knowledge are they bringing from their home country? How are they adapting to climate change? How do they deal with like the last few years? The weather has just been just all over the place. So like, how do you deal with snow in June and then 110 in July? And like, I'm so in awe of like how resilient they are. Last year we had the opportunity to do a research project with Global Gardens that we're going to talk about the next time we meet. But one piece of that study is to do a similar kind of study. And so the farmers are from refugee backgrounds, from many different countries around the world. And one of the things, we'll talk about the other parts of the study next time we talk, but the one area of research that I'm really interested in is, again, like what knowledge are they bringing from their home countries? And so we've been talking with farmers here in town who have been farming since they were children, like 5 or 6, and asking them like, well, how do you deal with pests? Because they don't use any type of pesticide or herbicide. And You know, how do you know what to plant and how do you know when to plant it? And so we've been doing interviews and surveys and doing all these cool things to learn about the knowledge that they have and to really understand the contribution that they are giving to us here in Boise, not just in terms of food, but in terms of like allowing us to have these green spaces. And then what I really hope to do is understand like their contributions in terms of their intellectual, their knowledge of farming.
That is so cool. I'm excited to talk more about that with your students. You mentioned global studies, how you encourage everyone to study abroad. And I know some people might be past college, but they still want to travel. Do you have a certain mindset that you like to take into your travels when you're going to another country? Or any insight you give to your students who are about to study abroad?
I have an example that I can share with you. So I was in Greece a few years ago and was visiting a refugee camp there kind of at the height of the Syrian refugee crisis and, you know, looking at, you know, these just huge communities of containers that people were living in, and it was hot. And I went to volunteer to help an organization that was putting in a beauty salon so that people could come and get their hair done. Really cool project. Yeah. And I was helping out, and a guy brought some wood in, and he was asking me where I was from. And I was in this like really great like space. I was helping out and was volunteering and feeling really good about that. And I told him I was from the United States of America. And it turns out he was from Afghanistan. And he looked at me and he said, why can't you tell your people to stop? Like, you're the reason I'm here. Mm-hmm. And it just totally took me aback. And so I listened to him. I didn't have an explanation. But the point of that story, I guess, is like, when you travel to just have that awareness that people's lives are complicated. And I think that like for me, like I learned like while that situation was giving me joy to volunteer and making me feel good, but that wasn't really the point of that. And he really brought me back to earth on that. But that was a hard moment. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what the advice out of that is, just to walk into new situations with a little bit of humility, I guess. And yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what I heard from your story, is a little bit of humility and listening and being there to listen and to learn as well. There's so many experiences you can have with the observer and curious mindset when you go into places.
Yeah.
So, well, Lisa, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that I didn't touch on?
No, thank you for having me. It's a great conversation. I'm really excited to bring my students here and talk more about research and hear things from a student perspective.
I am too. Thank you so much. Well, we'll chat again soon. In the meantime, see you guys later. Thank you for joining the conversation. For more information on how to be involved with refugee resettlement, please visit idahorefugees.org. Mosaics is produced by the Idaho Office for Refugees with grant support from the M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust. Music by the Afrosonics. Production in partnership with SB Studios.